It's just not possible to gain that much in value that quickly with declining revenue.
And that's when I really had the epiphany that investing was not about stocks and bonds. Investing is about innovation.
The belief is if there's a new piece of information, that it will be instantly incorporated into the price of the stock or the bond or whatever. But that's not how people change their minds.
Welcome back. I'm Hayden Brain, and you're listening to Opto Sessions, where we interview the top traders and investors from around the world, uncovering their secrets to success. Ali Ehrman is ARK Invest's genomics analyst, responsible for the company's research on gene editing, DNA sequencing, stem cell technologies, and immunotherapy. Spearheaded by one of the most talked about investors in modern history, Cathie Wood, ARK Invest's flagship fund received $1.5 billion inflows in the first half of 2022, even as a tech sell-off continues to hamper its top holdings. I last spoke to Ali in November 2021, discussing the basics of DNA sequencing and its overall potential. This time we discussed gene editing, examining her CRISPRSO analysis, a method for assessing the efficacy of three major gene editing technologies. For help understanding the ultimate investment potential in genomics, Ali's insight is unparalleled. We reference multiple diagrams throughout. Click the link in the episode description to find these on the ARK website. And remember, to receive a roundup of Opto's best content every day, subscribe to our newsletter by clicking the link in the episode description. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Opto Sessions, Ali. How have you been?
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today. I'm so sorry, Hayden. It's been too long, but I'm glad to be on and glad to be discussing, you know, gene editing again. It's exciting.
Yeah, no worries at all. It's fantastic to have you back. So like we always do, I'd like to start by asking a question that will give listeners an early indication of one of the key focuses of today's interview. And that is, as gene editing technology evolves, why is it so crucial that we consider and fully comprehend the risks associated with these burgeoning procedures?
Yeah, I think that's a really great place to start, because why is it so important to understand off-target edits? Why aren't we just saying gene editing? Wow, we may be able to cure disease. Isn't that enough? But if you think about what gene editing is, right, you're altering the DNA, you're making a permanent change. And so that really does hold great promise, and it's super exciting and potentially curative. But there are also some potential complications that I think are really important and like appreciate you highlighting, right? So understanding those risks is pretty imperative. To understand those risks, we believe, you know, at ARK, and I believe that that's becoming really increasingly important for the future of human, animal, and also even plant health. So just to give a little bit by way of background here, scientists discovered that this CRISPR-Cas9 protein was a really novel but also inexpensive way to target a DNA sequence. And it was actually done by using this CRISPR-Cas9 protein. And of course, we've now figured out that there may be some other newer flavors, but the most prominent ones that are really featured in the clinic right now are these CRISPR-Cas9 proteins. But these proteins, which are often referred to as molecular scissors because they can cut DNA, create these double-stranded DNA breaks. And when you break DNA, both strands, so double-stranded, that can cause an uncontrolled mixtures of things like indels, insertions, deletions, cell changes, translocations, P53 activations, chromothripsis, and other really large deletions at the target site. And then these byproducts that are generated are determined by the cell. And so they can't really be controlled by researchers. So it's not something we can say, oh, we're going to get this off-target edit. It's really each time and each person maybe even can have a different byproduct. And these byproducts could have biological consequences. Mm-hmm. So understanding that is super important. And maybe, Hayden, I can give an example of this just to... It seems so kind of, yeah, I know it seems so kind of out there, but, you know, several months ago, Allogene Therapeutics reported to the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration. They're the ones that approve all of our therapies in the US. One patient on its trial, which was an anti-CD19 off-the-shelf CAR T-cell therapy. So a gene edit happens before, and then this is a cancer therapy. This patient, they reported, had a chromosomal abnormality. And it has been determined since that this may have not been related to the therapy that the patient was on from Allogene. But the patient had a stage 4 follicular lymphoma. They had failed two prior lines of therapy. They also had failed some radiation. So clearly, like, this is a very, very sick patient, right? Mm. And even though this patient actually did respond to the treatment, they had a partial response, meaning some of the cancer did get reduced. A biopsy had uncovered this chromosomal abnormality. It was in the patient's bone marrow. Then, of course, you have to get a biopsy. So the biopsy was performed. And it was done so because the doctor was concerned the patient had low blood counts. And so this is low blood counts is a condition referred to as pancytopenia. Mm-hmm. And so once notified of the abnormality, the FDA kind of put the company's entire pipeline on clinical hold. And often we see the FDA put clinical trials on hold, but putting a whole pipeline on hold is something I haven't at least seen very often. Mm. Also, there are other companies that are using similar technologies, and the FDA didn't put all of these other companies' pipelines on clinical hold. So at the time, I sort of assumed, like, okay, maybe this is manufacturing. Maybe this is a specific problem that was related to this target. And of course, we know now the FDA has subsequently lifted this clinical trial hold and the clinical sort of hold on their entire pipeline. But I think it's important to discuss this in the context of, like, how can we better understand regulatory and complex safety issues for allo-CAR-T therapies, but also gene editing and gene therapies as well. So just to give you kind of an idea, Hayden, there are like a few different issues, right? So translocation, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. that's when a part of one chromosome gets attached to another. Then there's also deletion, which is when a part of the chromosome is deleted. There's rings, which are when a part of the chromosome breaks off and forms a ring. Duplications, when a part of the chromosome is duplicated. And then inversions, a part of the chromosome breaks off and is inverted and then reattached. Like, the idea here is just that understanding these risks is clearly very important. Also, something, sorry I'm being long-winded, but I'm passionate about from I appreciate your patience, but I think it's important to understand from, like, a clinical perspective, but also from a regulatory perspective, right? Like, how is the FDA and other governing bodies globally going to need to see from companies in order to approve this type of therapy, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I know, and I'm glad you went into so much depth, because I think that really sets the scene quite nicely, and at least highlights the risks of this sort of technology and the procedures taking place, which potentially discussions around this sort of topic don't necessarily always do. So I'm glad we've covered that off, and we'll get back to a few of those themes in a minute. But let's almost take a step back even from that to talk about the overall investment case in genomics. Obviously, that's something close to your hearts at ARC. And you highlighted, I think, in your recent Big Ideas report that the equity market cap of gene editing and gene therapy companies will scale from around $130 billion today to $1.1 trillion by 2026. So, you know, not only is this trend hugely significant, the rate at which that significance is growing is actually also increasing all the time. And that latest report, as I said a moment ago, points to gene editing's breakthroughs and how they're creating more effective therapies at a faster rate than ever before. So can you just help us understand why momentum in effective therapy creation is growing so rapidly right now?
Yeah, I think that's good to point to and really interesting. I also like to say, and when we think about sort of the macros that are affecting the broader market right now, I like to say, I think science is getting better and better. I think the tools we have are getting, you know, better and better. But, you know, obviously we've seen valuations and the market kind of have a broad sell-off, at least in the biotech sphere and more broad, I think, you know, also more broadly, obviously. But it seems interesting because company fundamentals, but also the science are really increasing. So we did highlight this in Big Ideas 2022, the $1.1 trillion potential market cap, and that's in 2026. But we also wrote a blog, which is up on the ARC website, which we talk about how tools and advances have helped drug discovery significantly. Mm. And I think that's also really important to your point of, like, how are we going to scale? So, for example, you know, if you think about tools like next-generation sequencing, artificial intelligence, CRISPR, but not only CRISPR, other gene therapies, other gene editing technologies, those all boost the efficiency of clinical trials. And then that in turn can, you know, shorten development timelines. It can reduce failure rates. meaning that the number of clinical trials that will be needed to produce commercialized products will be lower. And then, of course, that's going to obviously lead to an increase in return on your investment if that does come to fruition. So, you know, how we think about it is that the convergence between and among these technologies could really increase the effectiveness of the global healthcare system. And so it could add $9 trillion in market cap to the biopharmaceutical space during the next 5 years. And then we further wrote another blog where we kind of dimensioned out, like, not only is it going to be NGS, AI, CRISPR, and other sort of, you know, curative therapies, but also things like AlphaFold, right? And other of these neural network-based algorithms, they could even further reduce clinical trial costs and also efficiencies. So what does AlphaFold really do? Well, it lets you know the shape of a protein structure at the start of your research. And there's been research to suggest that that can actually reduce by about 50% the cost and time from discovery. You know, you're like, you're in ideation, you're thinking about this, to investigational new drug approval, which is when you go to the FDA and you're actually looking to get a drug approved and then go on to commercialization. So to put some context around this, if using AlphaFold or something like AlphaFold, some type of algorithm that can, you know, quickly determine a protein shape, and if that could improve the economics even more than using some of the aforementioned technologies alone, like CRISPR, NGS, AI. So basically, for example, based on some of the numbers that we've shown, if you use past clinical trial throughput rates, which we basically call in our research status quo, and that would be basically not using these technologies or not assuming that these technologies change anything, we estimate when using those rates that preclinical costs per commercialized drug would be about $243 million. But then if you add these technologies, so the first group, right, like NGS, AI, and you assume that those technologies do improve your throughput rates, then your preclinical costs per commercialized drug could be cut by more than half to about $103 million. And then if you're using these new predictive neural network-based algorithms, similar to AlphaFold, then you can even have those costs to about $52 million. So not only is like the significance growing, as you mentioned before, Hayden, because of these like new technologies and capabilities, but there's also, you know, we're seeing that CRISPR is maybe better than zinc finger nucleases or TALENs, but it's also this like we're further proliferating because it's also helping with reducing the clinical trial costs, the efficiencies. If drugs are coming to market quicker, that's also helping with, you know, the proliferation, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's fascinating. And I'll post a link to that article in our episode description just so people can get more detail there. I'll also be providing a link to the previous episode we recorded with Ali at least 6 months ago now, just so people have got the full context on some of the themes that we're discussing today. But after kind of all of the bullishness and the positivity that we've kind of outlined over the last sort of few minutes or so, what's the bear case here? And I'm talking specifically about R&D funding. That will need to be at a suitable level to support any further developments we make in this space. Is that likely to be increased to sustain momentum in this space, do you think?
It's so funny. So Hayden, just for context for everyone else, when we got on here, Hayden and I were just chatting for a little bit, and I was telling him that I'm known to be quite the bull in gene editing. So for me, this is, you know, out of my comfort zone. But of course, you know, we always have to think of, you know, what's the other side of the coin. And of course, there is obviously a bear case. I think it's not R&D funding, though, that I'm as worried about. So R&D funding, I think, is just going to be shifted from like other less curative therapies to more promising technologies.
Got it.
So one of the ways that I like to evaluate whether a technology looks like it's working, being utilized, is what are the scientists using, right? They have no skin in the game in terms of using a specific technology. And we've done some analysis on this where we look at, you know, PubMed and other similar websites like Medline. And these type of websites are sites that investigators can really showcase their research. So, you know, these are free sites. You can find references, you can find abstracts, and even full articles on life sciences and other healthcare and medical topics. And so in some of our original research, we looked at the past decade, and we looked at the concept of editing genes to cure genetic disorders. And we obviously have seen that it has received a lot of attention in these type of databases, especially really in these academic circles. As you know, as these articles move more and more towards the clinic, we'll see it kind of proliferate even further. But at least in the beginning, it was certainly in these academic circles. And we really see that after 2014, CRISPR-Cas9 really became this clear differentiator in gene editing. So, you know, I mentioned before, there are other methods, you know, like TALENs or zinc finger nucleases, but, and maybe Hayden can send a link to this too, but we do have a chart where we show that CRISPR-Cas9 just takes off kind of exponentially over some of these other modalities. And we believe that these technologies continue to prove their worth as potential one-time curative therapies. So as they continue to show that, funding then can shift from other therapies that just maybe have not proven as effective to this broader group, which really is showing tremendous promise. And I think also that gene editing can really be more of, you know, not necessarily a vertical, but, you know, cross pipeline. Like it's going into CAR T, it's going into cancer therapies, it's going into rare diseases. And so it's not kind of in this one bucket, but more so along all verticals. And so that will be one way where I think R&D funding won't be an issue. I think the bear case really is like, can these therapies be effective and safe as one-time therapies? And I think if they can be, the bear case will be harder to argue. But I think for now, that's the bear case that we need to kind of focus on. Are they durable and safe?
Yeah, got it. Okay, well, we've talked about those therapies being curative, and that's obviously the ultimate aim of this technology. You quote it, I think, in the Big Ideas report and on your website as well. The ultimate aim of technology like this is to cure disease. And if we consider that the ultimate destination, whereabouts are we on that roadmap to actually achieving that aim?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Whenever I hear roadmap, I'm just thinking of, you know, literally the timelines that have elapsed and how quickly the technology is actually, you know, coming to clinic. And I think we also did a Medium post, I think, on this, where we talked about, you know, predicting maybe base editing's trajectory or prime editing's trajectory based on base editing and how long it took, and it may be even quicker. And I think, you know, it's surprising and astonishing how quickly it's coming. And I think, as you mentioned, right, the goal is, can we cure disease, and how incredible would that be? And I think we've really seen some impressive data from some of these companies. And again, we're early days, but, you know, the further out we go, the more impressive it becomes. But in our early way of seeing some of this data, you know, we featured actually this recently in a newsletter, but Intellia Therapeutics and Regeneron, this was last year when they made history. This was at the Peripheral Nerve Society conference. They presented the world's first data on CRISPR-Cas9-based in vivo gene editing. So in vivo meaning that the therapy takes place within the body, ex vivo take place outside of the body. And they presented this data on patients with hereditary transthyretin-mutant amyloidosis polyneuropathy, which is a little bit of a twister there. Wow. But hATTR is a disease in essentially which you get these amyloid proteins that build up. And so if these are untreated, they can cause a lot of issues. But mainly the biggest one is that failure of multiple organs. And typically for cardiomyopathy, that's in the heart. And for polyneuropathy, what we're talking about here, it would be the nerves. And so what was really notable is that these researchers showed that editing the TTR gene could deliver a potentially one-time treatment, and that would reduce sustained serum TTR, which is what you want to see. And it would eliminate the need for chronic therapy, right? Again, exactly what you said we want to see. And then recently, so the end of June this year, again, Intellia and Regeneron showed this new interim data. They're doing a phase one. Again, that's very early in the clinical trials phase. So that's 15 patients, right? So a really small number of patients, but they were treated across four dose cohorts, which again is super normal for early stage development. And those patients showed sustained serum TTR reductions at all of the doses. And the first cohort had gotten to about 12 months. So we have almost a year of follow-up, which is getting to be pretty interesting. And then 6 months for the cohort that was at the highest dose, which was still seeing about a 93% TTR reduction. And that's the mean. So again, this is a small sample size, but it's just one example that I like to give because you're seeing the sustained serum TTR reduction. And I think that potentially indicates that this could be a one-time therapy to cure polyneuropathy patients who suffer with TTR. So again, one example. We have other examples like CRISPR Therapeutics and Vertex, who are working on sickle cell and beta thalassemia, which are hemoglobinopathy diseases. And I think we discussed in the last podcast, they've treated about 75 patients. So the number of patients is also getting bigger. We have Bluebird. They've paved the way in treating sickle cell and beta thal patients with gene therapy. So I would say, you know, we're early in treating patients, still small numbers like the examples I gave. But we'll continue, I think, to see a real proliferation of clinical trials in the coming years. And so, you know, early days, but we're in the clinic, we're treating patients, you know, and hopefully we'll see some approval soon, maybe with CRISPR and Vertex for sickle cell and beta thalassemia.
Yeah, absolutely. And then if we link that to investors and what they're going to be thinking about, which ultimately at this point is time horizon, what sort of time horizon should people be considering? And I think we can be as abstract or generic as sort of medium, long term, short term, which I doubt is the case. I don't think we need to put a particular year on it or anything like that. And obviously it's going to differ person to person, but can we try and sum up, I suppose, the general time horizon people should be thinking about for these technologies?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. And, you know, one we get all the time. It's like, are these happening in a year, in 10 years? What's kind of, is there somewhere in between? I think when you're investing in this theme, maybe it's not for the faint of heart, but, you know, you have to give around like a 5 to 10 year time horizon. And you have to keep in mind that most drugs take about 10 years from ideation to commercialization. So an expectation, I think, of around that long-term mindset timeframe should probably be applicable for a lot of these therapies.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's really helpful.
We hope you're enjoying the episode. For interviews like this every Thursday, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, make sure you give us a star rating and leave guest suggestions along with any other feedback in the review section. Now, back to the show.
I think we can use this juncture then to move on to your CRISPRSO analysis, which is a subject we teased at the start of the interview. So let's get into it now. As I say, you recently ran a fascinating CRISPR analysis that I read on your Twitter feed, I believe it was. Firstly, can you just explain for anyone that hasn't read it what CRISPRSO analysis is and what you're aiming to achieve and convey as part of that analysis?
Definitely. So this was an analysis I ran, which I posted on Twitter. I think it was featured in a newsletter also. And then this will actually be coming out as a full blog. So teaser on that, probably in the next coming weeks. So this is really exciting to do the podcast kind of almost at the same time as we're going to launch the blog. So stay tuned for that, and also very exciting. What is CRISPRSO? So CRISPRSO is this tool that I was introduced to. And first of all, the name is amazing. So that's number one. I would love to know if anyone knows how they came up with that name. Would love to know because I think it's really funny and awesome. But what it does is it analyzes the outcomes of gene editing agents at the DNA level. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to focus on understanding the efficiency of these different gene editing technologies and also think about the off-target edits. So what CRISPRSO does is it uses amplicon sequence data. So you get that. You can typically find those in files that are in sort of the supplemental information from papers. You kind of have to go digging around for it. All papers should have it. Some do, some don't. You basically have to take those files and then upload them to CRISPRSO. And then that will help with determine the editing efficiency and also, you know, the safety profile. So those off-target edits. And what it will do is it analyzes and then it generates these allele plots. And essentially what an allele plot is it's a visualization of gene dynamics that are focused on changes that happen during the gene editing process. So you may need to visualize it. So you may need to either go to Twitter or the newsletter or hopefully the blog in a couple of weeks, because I think seeing those allele plots are really helpful for understanding this. But hopefully that's helpful enough for the podcast and maybe even gets you interested enough to check out it online via one of those avenues.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we publish our accompanying article on Opto, we can also include maybe some of those images just to, as you say, make it a little bit less abstract. But links to the blog as soon as it's live will be available on Opto as well. So gene editing outcomes vary between the different technologies, which obviously you were alluding to in your answer there. But which technologies sort of proved most effective? Can you flesh out how these results differed between each technology?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to backtrack for 1 second and just talk about which ones we did, just to give context for everyone. So we looked at these three technologies. So one was CRISPR-Cas9, base editing, and prime editing. So those were the three technologies. So just a very quick reminder of what those are. CRISPR-Cas9 is really this novel and inexpensive way to target the DNA sequence, as we talked about before. So you would use a CRISPR-Cas9 protein. Although we also mentioned, again, there are other flavors. I used CRISPR-Cas9 for the first one. And that would be a way to get to a specific DNA sequence. And then you're going to want to disrupt a gene when you use that. These proteins, as we said, are often called molecular scissors. And they create these double-strand DNA breaks, which can cause some issue like we talked about. But then there's also base and prime editing. Base and prime editors are different because they nick one strand of the DNA, but they don't make this double-stranded DNA break. So the Cas9 domains have one nuclease domain that's actually inactivated, which is why you have one strand of the target DNA that's nicked, but you don't get those double-stranded breaks as opposed to, you know, this typical Cas9 that you'd see that with. And cells in our bodies experience thousands of nicks every day, but they don't really typically experience a lot of double-stranded DNA cuts, which is why we kind of want to avoid that, because we're not sure what the outcomes will always be. So CRISPR-Cas9 can really effectively disrupt a gene, but we're not sure the utility beyond that. But of course, we do need to use CRISPR-Cas9 for base and prime editing or some form of nuclease or protein, but it's inactivated, so it works a little differently. But base editing could actually disable or enable a specific genetic function because it corrects a single letter in the genome. So that's why base editing is different. And then prime editing also adds additional functionality to the Cas9 protein. It can also potentially treat many more rare and complex diseases because of that functionality. So what prime editor does is it involves and disables Cas9 proteins. It does not make those double-stranded DNA breaks, which is exciting, but it still can target by a single guide RNA. So it attaches to an engineered enzyme. It's called a reverse transcriptase. And what transcription means is it describes this process, which is how a DNA template produces RNA. And then a reverse transcriptase, which is what we use in prime editing, does the opposite. So writing DNA with an RNA template. Okay, sorry, long-winded again, but I think that we needed the context for what we were analyzing to kind of figure out like what proved most effective, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't think there's a technology that's going to be like the most effective, right? It's likely going to depend on the indication and then also your risk tolerance, right? How is this a disease in which everyone is dying? There is no other option. Your risk tolerance might be higher if that's the case. Or is this something that has a lot of approved therapies for, then I think your risk tolerance goes down. And this isn't only your risk tolerance, of course, this is also the risk tolerance of the FDA and other governing bodies. So I think those two factors are important for which, you know, tool you might want to pick up in your toolbox. You know, an example of this, we've talked about TTR, we've talked about sickle and beta thal. Those may be good options for gene disruption. So CRISPR-Cas9. Because you're disrupting a gene there. And so you maybe don't need as much precise editing. But more complex diseases like Tay-Sachs will likely only be able to be treated, at least for now, with something like a prime editor. And then if we talk about kind of like what were the results of the actual analysis, well, we give these allele plots and pictures. And again, Hayden, maybe we'll be able to put them up and be able to show for readers to understand. But if you look at the CRISPR-Cas9 example, which was a disruption in the HEK3 gene, you can see that there is a lot of different possibilities that can happen from this. And again, that's because we can't really predict the outcomes. This is your body's own repair mechanisms doing the work. They make those double cuts in the DNA, and your body then repairs itself. And so because we can't necessarily say what exactly will happen, in the allele plot, we see a ton of different options. And you can see when you see the allele plot on the right-hand side, what percent of the time those outcomes happen. And then when you look at base and prime editing, so the example we did for base editing was an A to G edit, but it was for PCSK9, which affects LDL or lower density lipoproteins or bad cholesterol. And in the allele plot, you can see, and hopefully we can get these uploaded or you can see them on Twitter, they showed no visible off-target edits or indel creation. But they did reveal something that's called a bystander edit, which means that within a specific editing window, they may have had other edits within that window. But what investigators will try to do is make sure that within that window, there would be no other A to G edit that would be harmful. And then 35% of the time, there was also no editing for the base editing example. So I think that's important to highlight. And then in the prime example, like I mentioned, this used PE5 max. I think they've gotten even better since then. But this was a G to T edit at the PRMP locus in HeLa cells, something that currently you can only do with prime editing. And you know, this edit, you see there were no visible indels. You can see there's like two lines in the allele plot. It looks way, way cleaner. And though the editing efficiency was 32%. So I think we need to get better and better at editing efficiencies, but it's clear that the base and prime editing outcomes from this analysis looked way cleaner than the Cas9 analysis.
Yeah, fantastic. No, it's a really nice run through. And yeah, we will host those images on Opto and include any links in the episode description just to make it a little bit less abstract. And again, just to bring it home for people listening, I suppose, and to clarify it as much as we possibly can. Perhaps if you could give us some applications, like real world applications that these technologies are used in, maybe one for each or one for two of the three, and to provide examples for one or two of those would be really helpful at this stage, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I know this can seem kind of abstract and very tedious. And I don't think there are many people who've done this sort of corpuscle analysis, but I think it's really a way to showcase some of the risks, but also, some of the improvements and sort of interesting functionality that we're adding with better and better technologies. So for examples, we've mentioned in terms of Cas9, sickle cell, beta thal, TTR, are all things that are being currently worked on and in the clinic. So I think those are the best ones we can give for Cas9. Mm. I think for base editing, a really good example is PCSK9, which is actually the one I did for the analysis. That's lowering that LDL, as I mentioned, or that bad cholesterol. A company working on that is Verve Therapeutics. And they did some pretty interesting research on this. Maybe we can include a link to this one as well. But they did a side-by-side comparison where they showed a Cas9 nuclease and a base editor focused on PCSK9 specifically. And Verve was technology agnostic, so they didn't really have any sort of reason to choose Cas9 over base editing. They were going to get it from a company and license it out. And they chose to work with a base editor because it had better efficiency and it had lower off-target edits. So I think that's a really nice sort of way to encapsulate what might be good for PCSK9. And then for prime editing, TSAX is probably a good example there. Basically, for TSAX, you need to do an insertion, and it's a large insertion. And so that can only currently be done with prime editing. And just for context, for anyone who maybe doesn't know, TSAX is this really quite rare genetic disorder that essentially will destroy cells in the brain and spinal cord, unfortunately. It's, passed on by your parents. And if you have it, then you're really lacking this enzyme that helps you break down, this specific fatty substance. And that's why, this gene insertion is needed for that specific disease.
Got it. No, that's really helpful and definitely makes it less abstract. And I guess my next question then is, I guess with the evolution of these technologies and their their growth in terms of scalability, and as they proliferate amongst different companies and throughout the world, I suppose, as well, how likely is cross-licensing between each of these technologies? And practically speaking, what might that actually look like?
Yeah, so I think cross-licensing is super, super likely. I would highlight, though, that like not all technologies are created equal.
Yeah.
And some might be worth more than others, but certainly cross-licensing among these companies is the likely outcome. I think at the end of the day, we all want what's best for patients. And so I think that companies will be definitely willing to allow adoption of other technologies for some type of royalty stream. But I think it's also important to highlight, and we should remember, that the patents for a lot of these technologies for CRISPR were granted in 2012 and 2013, respectively. So, you know, there's that patent fall-off cliff, right? So 20 years. So they actually just featured a couple nice articles on the fact that CRISPR is about 10 years old now. And so they'll fall off that patent cliff in about another 10 years. So that will be 2032, 2033. And as we've mentioned, right, it takes about 10 years to commercialize a drug. And so the question is, like, how viable are the patents actually going to be in 10 years? Because a lot of them will have fallen off that patent cliff. And so it depends when the deals are made, who the deals are made with. So cross-licensing is likely, but also I think keep in mind kind of timeline is a good one here.
Yeah, really good point. And then if we finish by almost coming full circle and taking a step back and looking at the original discovery of CRISPR, the Cas protein, CRISPR-Cas9, it's been the most successful gene editing technology in humans thus far. But how widely and frequently is that technology being used right now? Give us a sense of how widely that's used in current life.
Yeah, it's almost ubiquitous at this point, right? Like I mentioned, I think it's going to be just used across so many verticals. I mean, if you even just think about who's using it, right? So we talked about PubMed or Medline and looking at all these, you know, academic centers or academic labs that are using it with their research, and we read their papers, and so we know they're excited about the technologies. But then think about now, like it moving towards, you know, large cap pharma, right? Vertex and CRISPR have it. Pfizer has a partnership with Beam. Regeneron has a partnership with Intellia. Novartis is working on it, right? So it's in these small micro cap to mid or SMID cap kind of companies that are working on really innovative tools. And then a lot of those companies have partnerships with large cap pharma. Some of the large cap pharma have their own teams working on it. And so I think it's almost going to become ubiquitous in the sense that everyone is working on it, from academic labs, from hospitals, from, you know, large cap pharma, small cap pharma. So I think this will just become more and more widely used. So, you know, expect to see a lot more of it in the coming sort of years.
Yeah, great. And just from a cost per treatment perspective, or perhaps you can give us a more general sense of how scalable the technology is right now. Do the costs need to come down at all to reach that ultimate scalability that you were just describing then?
I think cost is always really, really tough because we always want to say, you know, cost doesn't matter, but pharma and the companies that have worked on these technologies do need to get a payback. I will say this was work we did a couple years back now for Big Ideas, but we highlighted if you look at a drug and then you look at the drug per life year, right? So it's not a fair comparison to say something like Zolgensma, which is a gene therapy for spinal muscular atrophy, which is at about $2 million. It's not fair to compare that to, let's say, a CAR T therapy that you're consistently going to have to take. You need to have a way in which you can quantify how much a one-time treatment should be, because there's a lot of costs that you're going to save on, right? You're going to save on potentially going to the hospital with, you know, vaso-occlusive crises, or you're going to save on, you know, meds, or you're going to save on happiness, you know, if we put in the patient's actual experience. And so I think a cost analysis where you look at, you know, cost per life year versus total cost, I think you could see that some of these really high price tags may actually be cheaper for a patient if you consider it by cost of life year gained. And so that's kind of how I would look at it. I can't unfortunately give, you know, an exact number for what would be scalable, but I think also as the technologies continue to improve, costs can also come down significantly as well.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Completely makes sense. And I think that's a good point to end the main body of the interview, but I want to finish with our opto question. I like to, when I'm speaking to domain specialists and experts such as yourself, to finish with a question to get a sense of the most exciting theme, sub-theme, or even an individual technology that they're looking at right now. And it could be something similar to what we've already discussed, or it could be completely different. So perhaps you can give us the next big idea in the genomic space.
Oh, goodness. Such a tough one. And I don't know if I can just focus on one. So maybe I'll give kind of a little basket. But I think, you know, thinking of genomics, I like to just call it omics, right? Because there's proteomics. There's so much that goes into it. And I think the next frontier is really exciting. From a gene editing perspective, you know, I'm still really excited about prime editing. I think being able to do large gene insertion is really interesting. And I think the amount of diseases that we'll be able to treat within a rare disease context is going to go up. And so if safe and effective, I think that's a really, really exciting technology. I think the idea of epigenetics is quite interesting and exciting, right? The idea that your behaviors, your environment, and things of that nature could actually maybe cause these changes that affect you on a DNA level. And I think that is pretty interesting. And the effect maybe, you know, how your genes are, how they work. And so I think that's pretty interesting. And I think that field of study will get more and more interesting as companies continue to proliferate and getting into that space. And, you know, obviously there's been a big increase in longevity interest. And so I think if we can create longevity companies and therapeutics that are safe and effective, but also are creating value, then I think that would be really interesting as well. So a lot of different options there maybe, but I think, you know, there's just so many interesting things happening in therapeutics right now. And I think because of the pandemic, people really saw the power of, you know, what therapeutics can do and how quickly we were able to develop an mRNA vaccine for the COVID pandemic, for the COVID virus. And so, you know, I think people realize how important this theme is to invest in, not only, you know, but to potentially make, you know, a profit, but also to increase, you know, the possibilities of therapeutics and potential cures for patients. So just really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. A few really interesting technologies and themes to look into for our listeners, and a perfect message and note to end on, I think. And that just leaves me to say thank you very much for joining me on the podcast again, Ali. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during the trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new products, stock reports, or webinars from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. And thanks also to CoFruition for consulting on and producing the show. Until next time. CoFruition.